From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the front lines of the COVID-19 epidemic and why Governor Whitmer ordered most of the state to stay home.
She said that could lead to 1 million people being hospitalized, and we have 25,000 acute care beds. So you do the math.
Also, what a stay-at-home order means for those without homes, the perspective from one Michigan shelter.
But we need help. You know, we need the rest of the community to take this, to treat this as if it's a disaster.
And later in the hour, a film fest goes online with a documentary about one of Michigan's most famous alternative high schools.
At one point, there were varsity jackets that students had that said Commie High on the back because they really wanted to embrace that sort of outsider status.
All those stories and much more coming up for you on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's governor, Gretchen Whitmer, has issued a statewide stay-at-home order today to curb the spread of the coronavirus. This after schools, many office buildings, and other kinds of workplaces have already voluntarily shut down. Here's the governor making the announcement this morning.
Without aggressive additional measures, more people will get sick, more people will die, and our economy will suffer longer. Without additional aggressive measures, soon our hospitals will be overwhelmed. We currently don't even have enough beds, masks, gowns, and ventilators. But if we all do our part and simply stay home, we have a shot at helping our healthcare system meet our needs.
Zoe Clark is the co-host of the podcast It's Just Politics, and she's also program director here at Michigan Radio. And she joins us with more on the governor's announcement. Zoe, hi.
Hi, April.
Who does this cover?
Everyone. I mean, look, it is a statewide effect, but there are, you know, sort of deemed essential services, right, that are still going to go on. And there are things that you are still going to be able to go do. You can still go to the grocery store. You can still go to the pharmacy and pick up medication. You can still go put fuel into your car. But this is sort of the next layer, this stay-at-home order, as we continue as a state to grapple with the coronavirus.
When does it go into effect?
It goes into effect tonight, or I should say first thing in the morning, midnight, basically tonight. And it's going to go until at least, the governor says, April 13th.
April 13th. So that's a little bit after we've heard schools, the school's horizon. I mean, obviously that could be extended, but right now Michigan schools are closed until April 6th.
Which this then extends that until the 13th. So you've got kiddos for at least another week.
Great.
Sarcasm there.
What do you imagine was the tipping point for all this? I mean, we've seen a cascading series of disturbing events with the gradually rising number of cases. What was it that tipped the scale?
Yeah, the governor basically said as much, and she said it's the numbers, and she used these numbers. Look, there are 10 million people in Michigan. She said if you go by the number that 70% could get it, that is 7 million Michiganders. She said that could lead to 1 million people being hospitalized, and we have 25,000 acute care beds. So you do the math. And this is getting again at trying to make sure that people are not giving it to each other at the exact same time to overwhelm hospitals. And that's the concern that we're seeing nationwide.
You know, it's kind of hard to grasp whether the language of this was intended to send a message to law enforcement that they need to crack down when they see people out and about, mm-hmm. or whether it's more of a psychological tool to encourage Michiganders to take this seriously. What's your read?
I think you've said it beautifully, and I want to say yes. The two are not mutually exclusive, right? This is getting both for folks who don't quite, I think, get how serious this is. This is her saying, look, we're ramping this up. And also saying, you know, but this is what needs to happen and here's how we're going to do it. And it will be, she's saying, a misdemeanor if you try to have a party at your house. Like, this is the new norm right now in Michigan.
And as Zoe just mentioned, the number of confirmed cases in Michigan has soared above the 1,200 mark. And Governor Whitmer continues to deliver daily updates. Program Director Zoe Clark of Michigan Radio co-hosts the podcast It's Just Politics. Zoe, thank you.
Thanks so much, April. Stay safe.
The Michigan shutdown related to COVID-19 has already idled thousands of businesses, everything from food carts to huge auto plants. Claims to the state's Office of Unemployment Insurance rose And yes, this number I'm about to say is real, more than 2,000% from weeks prior. The social safety net may never have been under more pressure in living memory. With us to talk about what's happening is Luke Schaefer, professor of social work and public policy. He's also director of poverty solutions at the University of Michigan. Luke Schaefer, nice to have you back on Stateside.
Thank you.
We know that more than 100,000 people in Michigan filed for unemployment last week. Do we know anything about who's filing?
Well, let me just start by saying that these are unprecedented numbers in terms of a shock to the system. We've never seen it ramp up quite this fast, and these are some of the biggest numbers we've ever seen, maybe the biggest numbers we've ever seen. So this is quite a shock to the system, and they vary, right? So you've got lots of small businesses. You can imagine a lot of the ones that listeners frequent, whether it be bookshops or coffee shops or toy stores or restaurants that are closing down under the current circumstances.
Or auto plants.
Or auto plants, right, exactly. And some of these places have strong connections to the unemployment insurance system. For some of the groups of workers, that program's going to be a little less known. And then there are whole sets of workers, whole groups of workers who are going to have difficulty getting any help at all from unemployment insurance.
Why is that?
Well, our system isn't really set up to support self-employed workers, so there may be some avenues to get through. But generally, if somebody works on a 1099, somebody works off the books, they're not going to be able to get help. So imagine housekeepers who are coming in to clean homes or being called off by families. Maybe they work with a 1099. Maybe they work off the books. They're not going to be able to access any help. If you think of your handyman, if you think of folks who make a living doing ride sharing, all of these groups aren't really set up well to access unemployment insurance benefits. Even workers who are able to access unemployment insurance are going to get a relatively small amount. Michigan has the lowest maximum benefit compared to Midwestern states, set at $362 per week. That's about 35% of the average weekly wage. That's well short of the federal standard of 66%. So somebody who's making $40,000 and gets laid off, it's going to be tough to survive on unemployment insurance, even as it provides a really important benefit.
Luke, what kind of options do people have if they're in that situation?
So you might imagine some of our public assistance programs, like food assistance. So one of the good things in the first piece of federal legislation that came through was some increased and flexibility around access to food assistance. But a lot of the provisions actually target families with kids. But we had a suspension of work requirements for that kind of aid as well. One of the great things in that package also was suspending all redeterminations for Medicaid. Make sure people don't lose their health insurance during this time, either because of some sort of administrative mistake or otherwise. So those are good things, but there's a lot of gaps here, and especially as our economy has changed, they've only grown. And so I think that's why you see so many folks across the aisle really looking to a income for every American type program to fill in the gap around that, both from the right and the left. But even those can get really tricky. So some of the provisions that were under consideration in the Senate, by the Senate, would actually have fewer benefits, half the benefit going to families without income tax liability. And, of course, one of the ways that we distribute aid to low-income working poor families, sometimes called the ALICE population, is through refundable tax credits. So, you know, under some of the provisions as they've been constructed, childless couple making $150,000 is going to get much more in aid than a single mom making $15,000 working in a minimum wage job with one kid.
What traditionally happens during times of recession to the safety net? I mean, I know that that word unprecedented is getting such a tough workout these days, but what do we know about what happens?
In this case, unprecedented is true. And what's really different is both the scale of the challenge and how quickly it came on. So in other times, you can sort of see things building, getting worse month over month, and bureaucracies are able to make adjustments. When you go basically from zero to 60 in a time like we're experiencing right now for, say, the unemployment insurance system, it's very hard for bureaucracies to adapt like that. One thing we know is that programs that are entitlement programs, these are programs that are often more administered from the federal government. They respond to the need, and these tend to grow faster. So a program like Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, formerly called food stamps, that's a program that's really responsive to the economy. And you can see the rolls increase, and that's where a lot of the provisions were in the last package. But that's also only a program that you can use for food. And so it doesn't help you pay your rent. It doesn't help you pay your energy bills and buy toilet paper. And so there's a limit there. Unemployment insurance is a program that can, it's a social insurance program. It's meant to catch us all when we fall. But the financing is a little bit complicated, and states may run out. So there's going to have to be, if this continues for, you know, some considerable length of time, there's going to have to be help from the federal government. And that's what we saw during the Great Recession, where the federal government, some things kicked in, and so more federal funds became available. The federal government also had to extend benefits. And that's stuff that, you know, we're going to have to see how that plays as time goes on.
I wanted to ask about that specifically. I mean, the thought of states running out of unemployment benefits or food stamp benefits sounds pretty frightening. I mean, is it possibility? Do you think it's more likely that we'll see a freeze of benefits, or that states or the federal government are just going to have to borrow to get people through this?
Yeah, I think with those programs in particular, action is going to be taken. So with food stamps, it is totally responsive to the needs. And so that's a program, you know, that we're going to see continue and that people will be able to access. As many people are deemed eligible are going to get access to food assistance. With unemployment insurance, that's a bit more of an open question. And a lot of states were in a bad position with their trust funds in terms of the amount of money that was stashed away ready for when the economy went sour. And so it's likely that in a lot of places, federal action is going to have to be taken in order to extend those benefits. And I expect we'll see some of that in, you know, we saw a little bit of added funds for unemployment insurance in this first bill that went through Congress this week. I expect that we'll see more. And I think that's a smart move. That's something we absolutely have to do and should do fast to 100% avoid the type of situation that you just described.
Luke Schaefer is Director of Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan, where he's also a professor of social work and public policy. Luke, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm April Baer. They say the show has to go on. I don't know if they were really thinking about a global pandemic. While movie theaters are shut down, the Ann Arbor Film Festival is moving to online streaming. One of the films featured this year covers the history of a storied place in the public education landscape.
For the past 2 weeks in Ann Arbor, Michigan, parents and many children have been waiting in line in sometimes freezing weather. They're hoping to get into the school of their choice, the district's only alternative public high school.
Donald Harrison and his production company, Seven Cylinders, have matriculated a four-year project. It's a documentary film about community high school, the Ann Arbor school that's known for its free-spirited curriculum. The film is called Welcome to Kami High. It traces the school's origin story and the kind of experience it's given to thousands of graduates over the years.
I think that community high school's entire culture is built towards trying to make as many people as possible find that thing that they're passionate about.
What I walked away from that school with is confidence in that I can take care of myself. That was a big one.
It was phenomenal. I mean, I don't think I'll ever see that again.
Donald Harrison, who grew up in the Detroit suburbs, is the founder of Seven Cylinder Studio, and he produced and directed Welcome to Kami High. He's with us today. Donald, welcome to Stateside.
Great to be here with you, April.
So for the uninitiated, could you give us the breakdown of what makes community high school's curriculum unique?
Well, so it was part of this free school movement from the late 60s, early 70s, when there was a lot going on in the country that was very turbulent times. And so these schools started that were very anti-establishment, but really based on these humanistic ideas of what education could be. And so hundreds of these opened all around the United States. And most of them, if not all, pretty much closed down or evolved into something that's very much different.
A little more
sort
conventional.
Of traditional.
Yeah.
Exactly. And community high school to this day still has that same foundation, that blueprint and DNA in it, which is really expressing your individual creativity, developing who you are as a person. And it's really this humanistic approach to education, which is a different model and philosophy than what I came out of when I came, you know, went to a public high school here in Michigan.
The first time I ever heard it mentioned, it was described to me as, in its early iterations, as the Antioch College of public high schools. Is that fair?
You know, the reputation conversation is a fun one, although it can be a sore spot for some of the alumni because they were often labeled things like the misfits or the losers or the dropouts, the burnouts, things like that, which, you know, was a label put on something that was different. And when you're different, you get labels such as getting called a commie. And so that was something that most, not all, but most of the alumni embraced. At one point, there were varsity jackets that students had that said Commie High on the back because they really wanted to embrace that sort of outsider status. And, you know, eventually that started to become cool in the 90s.
You alluded to your own high school experience being much more traditional and standard than this. Do you mind telling us a little bit about that and maybe how that influenced your interest in community high?
Definitely. I think I went to a more typical high school. It was, you know, a big high school in the Detroit suburbs. And, you know, in many ways, it was considered a good high school. I did very well on paper in terms of varsity athlete and top of my class. But in terms of me as a person, it was the worst time of my life. And nobody would have known that. Nobody would have seen that or made sure that I wasn't slipping through the cracks. And so success at that point in my life wasn't something that I felt and experienced. And a lot of that had to do with what was going on in my family, the breakdown of my own family. But I then didn't have a school that was supporting me at a time where that really would have made a huge difference. And as you know, teenage years can be pretty tough on a lot of kids. And so, you know, for me, I got very interested in this place that did school differently and had this more humanistic, relationship-oriented approach to education and creates more of a family-like structure within a public school. And so that really got me most curious about it, especially when I heard that there had been a two-week camp out for students who wanted to get into the school in the 90s. And that sort of was my entry point, is trying to understand why would people camp out for 2 weeks or anything, let alone to go to a public school.
From the opening minutes of the credits, this is not exactly a standard loving treatment of a venerated counterculture institution. The tone of the music, the way images are sort of layered and collaged. You've mentioned that the film draws creative inspiration from the ethos of the school. What exactly did that mean to you?
Well, it's a place that's very much based on expression, self-expression, and really understanding what students are interested in and try to encourage them to pursue that. So that's something that is part of this idea of the school without walls. Community High is supposed to be involved with the community. And so for us, we really wanted to make sure that our film also had that expression and had a creativity imbued in it, and we really tried to make sure that there was sort of that life, breathe life into this portrait of a place, and looking at, well, what is possible within public education? That was really a question driving this film, and really try to make sure that we follow people, alumni and students. We followed a year in the school, 2016, 2017, which was a pretty pivotal year. If you remember a certain election, that plays out in the backdrop of our movie. And so for us, music is a character. Like the soundtrack, we have over 20 bands of musicians from Community High who contributed to the soundtrack. And that's a whole nother voice that helps carry these storylines through in the film.
There's so many priceless clips, sort of historical footage throughout the film, many of them videos produced by Community High students for assignments. One of them sort of runs like an infomercial.
Cotton underwear, get a close up on the cotton underwear.
Others are like punk rock videos. It must have been just a total joy going through all the found footage that you had access to for this.
I have loved working on this project, and that is one of the reasons. There has been amazing archival materials, and it's one of the aspects of our project I'm excited about still as we get the film done, and we're premiering at the Ann Arbor Film Festival, which is going to be very exciting to have that here in our hometown. But we're doing an online archive of all this extra material that did not make it into our 93-minute film. And there's gold. There's a lot of archival footage. There's articles from the Ann Arbor News that are all being put together in a partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library and will be publicly accessible on the second part of our whole documentary project.
It's an AV Club member's delight.
Exactly.
How has Community High School's persona had to change through the years?
You know, that's a great question because it's evolved. And if you talk to alum who went there in the 70s or the 80s, obviously times have changed and the school has changed with them. And the fact that it's still running, it's still, in existence, it still has those foundational blueprint philosophy that it follows, it is obviously not as radical. You know, when it first started, it was said that they didn't have any rules. No rules. There were guidelines, but there were no rules for this school. Well, of course, they had to put in some rules. And along the years, you know, when there were certain, you know, accidents or tragedies that happened, you have to adapt. And so the school really did adapt. But I think what I saw is that even though maybe it wasn't quite as, you know, it's not quite as quote unquote cool as it might have been in the 80s with the punkers and the skaters, it's still very much an alternative to what the traditional high school model, the more factory template-driven education that I came out of, it still is a very different place. And that was actually really brought to light for me when I had an opportunity to have a student from Ipsy High shadow me for a day. You know, I was asked if this kid who was interested in film could spend a day with me. And I was actually teaching a class at Community, working on our film with students at Community High. So I brought this young student from Ipsy there, and he wasn't at all impressed with the building and the facilities. It's nothing remarkable. It was an old high school that had been repurposed and closed down from desegregation in the 60s. And so the building and the facility aren't remarkable. But what he said after was the way those students there talked about being students and their relationship to the school was very different to him. And it's really this different culture, this different philosophy that we wanted to bring to life through this film and have people really ask questions about what are we trying to do with our young people as they grow into adulthood? Is it really this factory where they all learn kind of the same thing and get through it? Like for me, it was just get through it and then I can go figure out who I am. Well, why not start that when you're 14, 15, 16? And I will say that on this project, I've met hundreds, if not 1,000 alum, and it's an incredibly high ratio of these alum who talk about how they loved going to high school. Or they don't just talk about it in the way of, you know, I love my mascot or, you know, the fight song for my school, but they truly had a deeply profound personal connection with teachers, with other students, across classes. And that's something that really stood out for me. And it's a question that we want to make sure people are asking is what's possible and where are we heading with public education?
Well, what about that? I mean, watching the film, you get a strong sense of how few kids will ever have access to this kind of an education. The footage of the camp out, all of the interviews that reflect in one way or another a fact that this was a rare chance for them. I mean, and you don't sugarcoat the fact that very few kids of color have access to something like this, even within the lottery system that the district has set up. Does Community High matter if it's only a handful of kids who get this experience?
That is a really important question in our film. It's a question of access and equity. And so, you know, for us at this point, they came up with this lottery because it's the most fair of an unfair situation where you have so many students who want to go there and they don't have enough space for it. And so the school has made great effort to try to, you know, diversify the student body, but within the system it's in, there's only so much that they can do. And so it really, to me, it starts to get into these deeper, more complex questions of, well, who has access? And just because you say it's open to anyone doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to think it's for them, or, you know, you have even just getting to a place. And that's, to me, as we look at where we're at in the state of Michigan with education, which I think, you know, is one of, you know, ranking kind of towards the bottom in the United States, and where we're heading as a country with education, you know, we have this idea of school of choice, and yet who has the ability to drive their child across town or the next town? And so, you know, as we look at the systems, you know, rather than say, well, community is not available to everyone, let's get rid of it. To me, the question might be, what can we extrapolate from this? What can we learn? You know, it's not the perfect school. We shouldn't just have communities everywhere. But how does this work, and what can we do to build off of that and learn from it when we think about school of choice and the fact that right now that's not a fair choice for a lot of families and a lot of kids in our state and in our country?
There was one quote in the film that was so poignant. It was a parent who herself had gone, who was talking about the fact that she wanted to encourage her daughter to apply for the lottery, but her daughter like had this reticence. She didn't want to build herself up to the idea that she might get to go to this really cool school for 4 years and then lose the lottery, you know, not make out in the lottery and then have to go to another high school altogether. It so speaks to what happens when you have an opportunity that's so limited. I mean, what were your observations of watching the lottery process play out?
It's intense. You know, you had an alum, you know, who went there in the 80s at a point where they were desperate for students. They were trying to stay open. So they had to recruit actively to get students to come. And they had to overcome this reputation that this wasn't a place parents wanted to send their kid. And then as they started to have, you know, these great test results and started to sort of show that they actually could really graduate students who'd go off and go to college and do great things, that shifted. You know, early 90s, it became, you know, alternative became cool and community became the place people wanted to go. So then you fast forward and, you know, this alum who's in our film and we follow and get to know, her daughter's in eighth grade, and you know, we didn't know if she was going to be able to go, if she was going to get in. We weren't even sure she was going to even apply because, like you said, it's hard to want something and then not know if, you know, you're going to get lucky and be able to get in. And, you know, to this day, we just had the lottery draw for Community High, and I have friends whose children got in. They were very happy and excited, and friends who didn't, and they were upset. And so we still have a situation where there's not, you know, equity and access to education. And I have other parents who had a kid get in and go and a kid who didn't, and they sent them to private school. They had the means to pay, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. And they said that the quality of education was easily on par. And so if we can deliver, you know, private school quality education for free, but only for a small number who are lucky, what is that system really, really, why is it set up that way? What can we do moving forward to try to give that type of education or something like that to more students?
Did you get any surprises as you put the film together, either in terms of just what you saw and who you talked to, or how the school dealt with, you know, the very serious challenges that come up when you have an unstructured environment?
Yeah, we filmed, you know, a year in the life of the school, and we sort of made two movies in one, April. It was probably the hardest part of our film, is an archival film covering 45 years of a place that changed over time and really, I think, in many ways reflect a lot of the sociopolitical fabric of America over those 45 years. But then following a year of the school, and we didn't know what was going to happen, and we really sort of had to respond and follow what we thought was interesting and reflecting what was unique about this place. And that really led us into a storyline towards the end of the film where one of the students has, you know, a situation where her father's thrown in detainment and maybe is going to be deported. And this is early 2017. And so there's, you know, an entire school mobilization, and there's the local, you know, or the student newspaper, the journalist who covers the story, and it becomes a much bigger story. And to us, that was something we didn't know was going to happen, and so it surprised us. But then watching how the philosophy, the relationship of the students, the administration, the teachers, that played out in a way that we found really brought sort of this whole philosophy to life of what community is about.
Donald Harrison is the founder of Seven Cylinder Studio. His film, Welcome to Kami High, will premiere as part of this year's Ann Arbor Film Festival. Check the information on our website. Donald, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, April.
With the NCAA's March Madness tournament canceled, we're guessing your television viewing schedule is looking a little more open these days. You ready to fill it up with some movies? For the next week, Stateside is putting together its own version of a March Madness bracket. We've picked out 16 films set in Michigan, filmed in Michigan, or about Michigan. We want you to help us narrow it down to the most quintessentially Michigan movie of them all. Which film best captures the je ne sais quoi of the Mitten State? Find our list of Sweet 16 contenders at michiganradio.org, and then head over to Michigan Radio's Instagram page and click on our stories to join in. Today, we're pitting comedy against comedy. Listen to this matchup: Escanaba in the Moonlight, American Pie, Beverly Hills Cop, and Mr. Mom. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Governor Whitmer's executive order to stay at home takes on a very different tone when home is not an option. Shelters all around Michigan are struggling with their already complex work, helping people living on the streets with basic needs like food, medicine, and protection from the elements. Now they also need to try to stem the spread of COVID-19. Sarah Paspal-Jasinski is development director for the Shelter Association of Washtenaw County, and she joins us now. Sarah, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
First off, how does one do social distancing at a shelter? Our clients, have they been open to the idea?
Well, when you figure that out, let me know. Okay. But I can tell you we're working as best as we can to do social distancing, but it certainly can't be 6 feet. Our staff is definitely, when engaging with our clientele and each other, are practicing social distancing, but we know we can't police every single individual inside the building and make sure that they're following all the guidelines. We often make announcements throughout the day and constantly remind individuals, but we're incredibly limited on that space. So we have to help, you know, on one night with an offsite and in our building, about 180 people. We're servicing about 145 people in the building itself. So we're doing our best to, you know, definitely quarantine anyone that's presenting with any kind of health concerns at all onto a certain floor. But, you know, we're not being medical experts and only following the guidelines of, you know, what the state and government has to offer. We still have to take people in. So quarantining them on certain floors are big concern is about getting people out of the building that aren't presenting with any kind of illnesses.
And what is that? I'm sorry to interrupt. What does that mean, getting people out of the building who are not presenting with symptoms?
So that's one of our biggest challenges and needs right now. We have some faith-based organizations that have stepped up to the plate and have said that we could use their location remotely in the evenings to allow our healthy clients a place to sleep. And so we worked diligently to get that to happen, and actually three organizations have stepped up right now. But because of our staffing issues and concerns and not even having enough staff right now to manage our building, now we have no one to loan to these remote locations. So trying to encourage a group of volunteers to come out and just manage shelters, really makeshift shelters, from 8 p.m. in the evening until 6:30, 7 a.m. in the morning, with the basic of needs, just us providing mats and blankets. No food has to be distributed, just restroom facilities need to be used. We need now to find people that would actually be willing, one or two individuals, to sit in a room and sort of monitor people. And those needs are minimal. It's just sometimes they might have a question, or, you know, they're, you know, trying to practice that social distancing, making that announcement, okay, everybody spread out, that kind of stuff. We would fully protect any volunteer, of course, with the masks and the gloves, but, you know, everyone's practicing social distancing at home and not even going to work. Why are they want to go in a group of people with a room with 15 to 20 people and sit there and make sure that their needs are being met when they're trying to meet their own needs at home.
Right.
But that's really what we're in need of right now, so that we can, you know, flatten that curve and spread people out and provide, you know, housing right now for those that would otherwise be exposed to individuals in our building. Let me make it perfectly clear. We do not have any positive cases of COVID-19, but homeless shelters are incubators for illness right now. It's just a matter of time until we test someone positive and then the next person's positive and the next person. And imagine our staffing concerns right now when no one is even tested positive. What's going to happen when people do?
Right.
We've got to take care of people, and we are strapped for resources. We are paying our staff overtime with funding that we do not have. We are scrambling for medical supplies like the N95 masks, any kind of surgical mask, you know, Clorox wipes, disinfectants, surgical gloves. I mean, the community, you know, in their own homes are so fearful that they're, you know, scooping up all those supplies, where right now we've got an order in. We can't even get stuff until May.
Wow.
You know?
How close is the space to capacity right now?
Oh, I don't have that on the top of my head. We have four floors. One floor is our cafeteria and our entranceway, and our cafeteria is managed by food gatherers right now. So we actually have to have people lined up outside to eat so that we can practice social distancing. So we're not trying to have more than 25 to 30 people in the cafeteria at once spread around, where normally 100 would sit. So our first floor is, you know, for meals and entrance. Our second floor is being completely quarantined for anyone that's presenting any kind of illness. And it's very difficult to keep people inside the building. People want to go outside. They want to leave for a little bit. And we're having to tell people, if you leave the building, you cannot come back in. And it's such a difficult decision to have to make, but we're trying to protect everyone with the limited means that we have. Our third and fourth floors are residential floors for clients that have been provided shelter for a couple months at a time, and those are the individuals that are wanting to get out of the building to keep their health intact. And so we're going to have to be expanding, you know, those that are not well onto our third and fourth floors. So, you know, we're looking for the community to really step up, you know, hotels to offer us some space to send clients, you know, lawmakers to be really looking at this critical situation of how are we going to help those experience homelessness, you know, when illnesses are, you know, increasing at an alarming rate every single day. We're just pretty much, I guess, treading water right now. What are we going to be doing when the situation exacerbates? We have to put those contingency plans in place, so lawmakers have to step up to the plate. We need people. We're willing to pay volunteers right now. We don't have the funding for it, but we'll find the funding. We'll go in the red if need be, just to protect people and keep them safe. So, you know, we're stretching ourselves to the limit. We need help in the community. We need, you know, maybe retired military to manage sites that we're able to secure. We need, you know, retired people that are in good health that feel that they could help to manage this. We need, you know, people, medical staff that are either retired or not working, you know, to give us a call and consider managing our off-site locations. And eventually, I mean, we're going to need those healthcare providers to come inside the building. I mean, we are acting like a medical facility without medical facility support. Your hospitals have, you know, the equipment and the majority of the staff in place to help and manage what they have. We're acting just like they are without that support system.
Sarah, how is the weather playing into what's going on right now?
Well, we operate what's called a warming center. So from November through the end of March, we are able to help that additional 100 plus 130 people. When warming center ends, we have to turn people out into the streets. I, with a good conscience, cannot fathom doing that. I mean, people are sick. They're frightened. Their immune systems are already at risk. If you're on the streets for 1 year, that exacerbates your health and age by 15 years. Over 35% of our population are senior citizens. I've got to turn a 70-year-old woman out onto the streets now that warming center ends and saying fend for yourself, and now there's no more public spaces they can even go into? We'll continue to allow people that don't have shelter to come into our facility and take showers and eat a meal in the cafeteria. But there might come a point where we can now no longer do that. So we're struggling just to provide that shelter for people. So that's why we're asking people for off-site locations. We need organizations that would normally help the American Red Cross, for example, to come in and help us, to say, we've got the space, we've got the volunteers, we will help you. So when the warmer weather comes, it's going to be slightly easier to tell people, you know, here's a tent or here's, you know, a park to sleep in, which is better than being out in the snow. It snowed here last night, as you see.
Right. In Ann Arbor.
You know,
yeah.
If people are becoming more and more ill, what are we going to do when people are ill out there? Let people die? No. This is a community burden. You know, the Shelter Association of Washtenaw County is willing to manage the ship, but we need help. You know, we need the rest of the community to take this, to treat this as if it's a disaster. When the American Red Cross has to treat people in a disaster, they've got a huge team of individuals that can come together and pull this off and provide temporary shelter for people that lost their homes. What about people that have no homes?
Sarah, what's going on with some of the other services that help people on the streets? What are you hearing from health clinics and maybe some other spots?
Yeah, well, definitely some health clinics are limiting their hours. They're managing, you know, case by case, so they may be taking in people with more serious illnesses right now, meaning, you know, related to the virus, but people with medical needs like heart, diabetes, some of those conditions, they're not being treated right now. We definitely have heard some facilities are doing computerized MD or having conversations with people, but even community mental health needs are going unmet. Community mental health in our community is really doing the best they can to, you know, allow workers to come on site to help those that are suffering from mental illness. But this fear has definitely increased and has had people, you know, behavioral conditions exacerbate and really work against us right now and themselves.
Are you getting any kind of guidance you mentioned a little bit earlier that you'd really like for the state and local governments to step up at this time. Are you getting any guidance from the city or the county or the cities or the state about whether some help might be available?
Well, there's definitely conversations going on daily with our executive director who's Dan Kelly, who's, you know, really thin right now, maybe sleeping 2.5 hours a night. So, you know, as they extend help, it's kind of like we have to wait to see what people are offering right now. And right now there has not been any significant change in what the community is offering to help us house people temporarily. We're hearing a lot of, you know, different regulations that are being passed on and, you know, different resources that we could call upon ourselves to get supplies and things of that nature. But it's not like one big organization has come to us and said, we've got you covered. We're going to take on this many people. We've got the supplies that you need right here. We've got the staff to help you right here. That is not something that's taking place right now and something we need more of. Everyone is just sort of treading water right now and thinking of their internal department and their own staff. Everyone's so concerned about their staffs right now, allowing, you know, temporary, you know, work from home. You know, we don't have that luxury. You know, we just don't. Our people have to be just like medical workers and be involved and engaged with our clients experiencing homelessness.
Just one last question about your volunteer corps. I imagine a lot of the folks who normally help with this work are people who are retired, who have a little time, who are a little bit older. How has You addressed this a little bit earlier, but how has that population been affected? I mean, are people just like maybe not showing up for their volunteer shifts?
Yes. Well, you know, when the schools started closing and all public spaces started closing, we had to we had to cease volunteer opportunities on site, and we sort of put that order out before people were even dropping off. But now we have to put that call to action back in place because we are staff strained. So we are posting volunteers opportunities again and asking for people with medical experience to come and help us. Many of our volunteers were not medically trained. Many would come in and, you know, help with cleaning down temporary mats and doing laundry and helping at lunchtime. You know, so that increases their risk and increases their exposure and being around more people. So we were looking to keep everyone safe and ceasing all those opportunities. But, you know, now we're desperate. We're now desperate to ask people if you are healthy and well enough and you have some medical experience and you're well equipped, you know, please consider coming to help us because we don't have anyone else at the moment.
What would you say are the most pressing needs right now?
You know, we are asking people to show appreciation to our staff. You know, we've got individuals and organizations that are sending meals. We have, you know, people that are sending cards and expressions of gratitude. We are financially strapped right now to help individuals to pay that overtime. So we definitely need people to look to, you know, our shelter and other shelters out there and offer their financial support. With increased financial support, we can pay people. You know, these people that we're looking at are volunteers. We can now pay people to come in where normally we wouldn't have the budget to pay more people. If people will, you know, financially help support us, then that funding can go a long way. Even with this increase in supplies that we're needing, you know, the funding can help us in that way. Really, this is just a call to action to everybody in the community. You know, I'd love it if, gosh, just from people hearing this airing today, we got hotels calling us and saying, we'll take in some people for you. You know, if people that do help the Red Cross, they're going to call us and say, we'll secure a location and volunteer. So we need physical human resources and financial resources and physical spaces. Those are our top three priorities.
Sarah Paspal-Jasinski is Development Director for the Shelter Association of Washtenaw County. Sarah, thank you for the work you're doing right now and for your time.
Thank you so much for giving this this opportunity to express what our needs are. I hope everyone is safe and healthy and willing to give a little bit more to their community. Thank you.
We read something interesting over the weekend. Dr. Howard Markell, a professor of medical history here at the University of Michigan and a longtime guest of Stateside, was the man who actually helped coin the term flatten the curve. If you've been listening to Dr. Fauci over the past few weeks, or if you've been reading articles about the spread of COVID-19, we're guessing you've heard this phrase many, many times. It's the idea that society takes measures like canceling school and public events, sheltering in place, all to slow the rate of infection over time. We asked Dr. Markell how he came up with it, and he said it all began while conducting research with the CDC about flu outbreaks in 2005.
We were talking about this concept of flattening the curve, and we designed a study of the 1918-1919 flu pandemic to look at those cities that would or did flatten the curve, that would take the tall epi curve, flatten it, and stretch it out over a longer period of time to not only help lessen the load on hospitals and doctors, but would also buy time for better treatments. And indeed, the cities that we studied that did those things did far better than those that did not. So when flattening the curve became popular again during this pandemic, I was not surprised because it's been a matter not of if there's a pandemic, but when. But I was both gratified and horrified to see that these very draconian and very socially and economically disruptive measures would be employed. That said, I have spent 20 years studying them, and I'm firmly convinced that they will help save lives. So it's a very interesting time in our history, and it's a very interesting time in my personal history and career.
Thanks for keeping us up to speed, Dr. Markell. I'm April Baer. We'll see you tomorrow. Stay safe.